Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jennifer Walmsley and I lead our EST work at Teneo in London. I'm delighted to welcome you to our event today on Section 172. How companies interact with their stakeholders is central to much of what we do at Teneo, and in our minds, Section 172 is where the ESG rubber meets the road, because it asks boards to tell us how they weighed up the often competing interests of different stakeholders, where they landed on important decisions. So a huge thank you to our panelists today for agreeing to share their thoughts on the question. I'd now like to introduce Andrew Hill, Managing Editor at the FT. He agreed to chair our discussion today. So over to you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Hello, everybody, and welcome. Thank you, Teneo, for hosting this event. I'm going to just lay out a bit how we're going to operate for the next hour. This event's under the Chatham House rules, so no attribution of anything that is said here without permission from any of the speakers. We are going to take your questions, and indeed feel free to put the questions into the Q&A box at any time during our discussion. And I will either weave them in or come to them at the end of the discussion. We are all live. Nobody is displaying as a cat, so we should be able to go ahead. Section 172 is, as you all know, a vital but novel part of the corporate governance landscape. And to quote from the FRC's comments last year about how it was being implemented by companies, it's not about stating compliance with Section 172, but reflecting the board's consideration of stakeholders in pursuit of success of the company. So this panel is really about how to make Section 172 make a difference, and not just to make it into the compliance statement that the FRC was critiquing. We've got four experts from different perspectives to discuss the issue. John Allen, who's the experienced chair of Tesco and Barrett Developments, Tracy Blackwell, chief executive of the Pension Insurance Corporation, Bindi Banger, partner at Clayton, Dubilier & Rice and senior independent director at GlaxoSmithKline, and Bruce Duguid, head of stewardship at EOS, part of the Federated Hermes Active Responsible Investment Group. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists just to give us a brief introduction and talk about from their perspective what they think is working and perhaps what isn't working in the application of Section 172. And I'm going to start with John. John, give us your overview of how it's working at the companies you're involved with.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Look, this is probably going to be uncontroversial rather than controversial, but I believe that Section 172 has had a distinctly positive influence upon the ways companies behave in the UK. I mean, it's encouraged what I describe as good companies to be braver and more forthright in making decisions that are in the long-term interests of the companies, their stakeholders, and of course the company itself. And it's easier with the backdrop of Section 172 to defend purpose-driven decisions which don't necessarily maximise short-term profitability. And I could quote as an example, and I can only really speak for Tesco and Barrett's on this, our decision to repay £585 million of business rates release given to us during the pandemic crisis, that clearly has had an adverse impact on the short-term profitability of the business. It could have been higher, but we believe was in the long-term interest of the company, its relationship with government, its relationship with many other stakeholders, and so on. And I could give you lots of other examples. So I think for good companies, it's been helpful. I think for companies that have been a little bit more backward in terms of moving forward in recognizing their responsibilities to stakeholders, then it's also had a positive influence. It sort of forced them rather than supported them in making the right sorts of decisions. And I think we're also being helped by the fact that investors are taking a broader view of what the companies that they invest in should be doing, driven in part, I think, by Section 172, but much more heavily by the wall of investment money that's now seeking socially responsible investment. So I wouldn't claim Section 172 deserves credit for the fact that our investors are now moving forward as well in terms of these sorts of issues. I think the company, to finish, frankly, the fact that companies are accountable and have to report in public on how they make decisions, how they've managed these trade-offs, and need to explain themselves is wholly positive. You know, I think we should be prepared to stand up and be counted. Tesco is having an interesting little interaction at the moment with ShareAction, who are threatening to put down a resolution at our AGM, or forcing us to publish the progress we're making in helping reform people's diet. We're on exactly the same page as them. And the issue, I think, is going to be whether we can convince them ahead of the closing date for that, that we're already doing what they're asking us to do. But again, you know, I welcome the fact that people outside are taking an interest in what we're doing. We won't always agree with the speed at which they want us to do it. We've got to manage trade-offs there. But the fact that there is public debate about these issues, I believe, is almost wholly positive.
Let me just ask one follow-up question, John, about that decision, interesting decision about the return of the business rates relief. I mean, it was a unanimous decision by the board. Was there a long discussion? And I suppose from a 172 point of view, is that a discussion that you will go into when you're drawing up your Section 172 statement?
Well, I imagine so. We haven't got to that point yet. But yes, no. It was quite a long discussion. We had two sessions over 2 days because we had a two-day board meeting. We had a preliminary discussion, asked people to think about it overnight, and then came back together. We did discuss Section 172. I have a document that sort of explains why doing that was consonant with our Section 172 responsibilities. So I would be very happy, I think, at some stage, whether in the annual report or elsewhere, to give a public explanation of why we came to that outcome. I think for companies that are already there and believing that they have responsibilities to a quite diverse set of stakeholders, I don't think Section 172 is onerous at all. I think it's sometimes helpful in persuading, being able to justify decisions. Not every investor is still fully enlightened on this topic. Being able to justify those decisions to some people who are a little bit behind the curve on this. So I wouldn't say that it led us to the decision, but I think it will help us explain the decision.
Right, great. Well, we'll come back to some of those issues, I'm sure. Let me turn to Tracy from a slightly different perspective at Pension Insurance Corporation. Tracy, how do you see Section 172 working from your perspective, or indeed not working, if you've got any thoughts about flaws?
Yep. So first of all, I just might explain who Pension Insurance Corporation is. So we're an insurance company that focuses on insuring defined benefit pension schemes, one of the largest financial services companies in the UK you probably haven't heard of. We manage around about 50 billion in assets and liabilities for our policyholders. And we have a purpose, and our purpose is to focus on paying the current and future pensions of our policyholders. That's kind of what we're all about. But that means we're very long-term in nature, and we think long-term in nature. So that also means that we already, without Section 172, focus on all of our stakeholders, because we really are focused on the long-term. We've also been very instrumental in a wider debate on what we call the purpose of finance, which is getting the finance industry to kind of focus back to on what it's really there for, on who it's helping and what the purpose of the industry is. And Section 172 to us is just part of a broader trend sweeping through companies. It dovetails with ESG, more on the S and the G, which is a good thing, because I don't think that necessarily gets as much airtime as it probably should. But Section 172 really needs to be more than just box ticking. It's great at having companies describe how they're doing something, but it comes back to what we've always talked about in terms of purpose, which is you need to start with the why you're doing something, and then which is your purpose, and then the how you're doing it, how you're engaging all of those stakeholders should come back to it. But this whole current direction of travel is definitely gaining pace, and it recognizes that the system doesn't actually work all that well for everyone, and we need to spread the proceeds of wealth creation more widely through the economy, including and importantly to 10 million new pension savers through auto-enrollment, which is a huge force that we're going to start seeing come to the fore. But in order to reform all of this, it isn't just about reporting, it's about also reforming the financial services industry and how it's regulated, in particular to address this short-term outlook of investors. And companies can do all the reporting, but actually it's crucial that asset owners are the drivers behind some of this change that we're seeing. And we definitely see some, Hermes is one of them, but there are many that are not. And so those structural reforms in the financial services industry, in asset ownership, really is important to really get momentum behind all of this. Good example in terms of reform is the tax treatment of debt versus equity, which has come up at pretty much every single purpose of finance discussion we've had about why the system doesn't necessarily work. But I think we have a really good, we're at a really interesting time right now because Brexit and the government's current review of the future regulatory framework are really key moments in this overall shift, and we can build momentum and the groundwork can be laid to ensure that the system works for everyone.
Great, thank you for illuminating that. Just one question. I mean, is PIC looking more closely at the analyzing those Section 172 reports? I mean, is that now something that you're habitually doing in order to assess the S and the G in particular elements of ESG?
We're slightly different as an insurance company in a long-term insurance, life insurance company, we're debt investors rather than equity investors. And I would say that equity investors probably are the ones who are going to spend a lot more time on this. As a debt investor, I always say that debt investors kind of already do this because what they need to ensure is that the company they're lending to, especially if they're lending to the long-term, pays them back. And in order to ensure and understand that someone you're lending to for 30 years is going to pay you back, you need to ensure that they are sustainable. And I don't mean environmentally sustainable, but all the S and the G sustainable as well. So we kind of already look at it in terms of our overall investments when we decide. We haven't necessarily written it down in that way, but absolutely you need to do that in order to invest for the long term.
Right, thank you. Vindi, let me turn to you. You've got the perspective from GSK and other boards about the discussion about how you enunciate your Section 172 responsibilities. What are you seeing that's working from your perspective?
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. I think you'll find my remarks quite consonant with what Tracy and John have already outlined. And I know it's not the intent here to talk about private companies, but should that be of interest, we could return to it if we have time at the end. I think I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about, you know, why Section 172 came on board. ESG has been around for a very long time. So why was it necessary to add Section 172? And clearly it was because there was a feeling around among some investors, quite a few perhaps, regulators, politicians, activists, that actually companies were overtly focused on short-term shareholder value. 172 is entirely convergent with the concept of ESG, as Tracy said. And one of the questions I have in my mind about reporting is just, I just hope that these two don't continue on separate tracks, either for thinking about business, how you run business, about strategy, about planning, or indeed reporting. So I'd like to make it clear that I support fully the intent of Section 172, and companies should report on it in the manner in which, the spirit in which is being hoped for. Now, in terms of what's working, what's not working, well, clearly, as far as reporting is concerned, Andrew, you've already, you know, said what the FRC said, which is that, you know, this needs to be deeper than just saying what's happening. It needs to go deeper. But I think the important thing is reporting can only be as good as the substance. You can't report unless there is substance. And the substance is about how business is strategized, how it's done day to day, how it's lived. And here, I believe, there is a continuum amongst companies. Plenty remain very focused on the short term, and they are treating this as another reporting exercise. In my view, they do so at their peril. Because actually, as John pointed out, and we've heard from Tracy, and I have no doubt Bruce will say this, the investors are really clear about what they are, what the direction of travel is. One misstep by a company today costs it very dearly. Now, the best companies have always thought long term. And that's why, by the way, you think about companies like GSK and Unilever, which I've been privileged to be associated with. That's why they're here in the long term. Back to Tracy's point. You know, they have always thought long term. But I think we should be realistic. The vast majority are in the middle. And these companies are moving. As John said, this has been an encouragement for them to move. The direction of travel is clear, but I think they're moving quite slowly. And my personal opinion is that it'll take something quite big. Either it'll take a crisis or a leadership transition, a new CEO, a new chair, to bring about a discontinuous change in companies to think more about the long term. I mean, the crisis is obvious. Think about Rio Tinto and the lesson they've learned. Will they change? Oh boy, I'm sure they will. In terms of leadership transition, you know, it's quite hard for existing leaders to change the strategy from short term to long term. It's really hard. And that reset can happen when you have a new leadership, either in the form of a new chair or a new CEO. Now, you know, if I touch upon GSK very briefly, GSK has always been focused on the long term. And they have actually pretty much worked their business strategy like this. It has a clear purpose. The purpose is supported by three long-term priorities: innovation, performance, and trust. And innovation is about new medicines that are really reasonable, meaningful for the world. Performance is about performance, and trust is all about what we're discussing. And if I pick out just two items on trust, we have 13 elements that we focus on. One of the key things is to make sure that our products are affordable and available. And this is about drug pricing. I mean, this is one of the most complicated areas on how you price drugs and where you price them in different parts of the world. And we are committed to pricing at responsible levels, but also levels that are sustainable. And I think an external validation of this, of GSK's actual delivery on this, is the fact that we are rated number one amongst pharma companies on the Access to Medicine Index. Another external validation is that we are rated as number one on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index for pharma. So these are external validations that the company is walking the talk. And the reason why it's walking the talk is because what I'm describing to you is not an ESG program which is outside on the periphery of the company. It's at the heart of the strategy of the company. And I think I'll just close there by saying, I personally have always believed that businesses are successful in the long term only by being very thoughtful about the multiple stakeholders that 172 actually outlines. That is how real shareholder value is driven. But this is a belief system, and you can't invent it if you don't have it overnight. So just by asking for something to be reported, I think it won't happen. We have to wait and actually encourage companies and support companies, and the investors play a very big role here to help them actually get on to this journey, because it'll be better for them.
Right. Thank you, Vindy. No, thank you. I mean, it's obviously important to bear in mind that this is relatively early days for Section 172, as you mentioned, but all the more reason, I think, to get it right now before it kind of ossifies into boilerplate, which would be a bad outcome, I think. Bruce, over to you from the Hermes EOS point of view. Obviously, you've got an interest in that long-term and stakeholder engagement. How does it look as though it's working from where you sit?
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, just a brief introduction to Federated Hermes. We're a global asset manager managing approximately $600 billion of assets. We also represent, for stewardship services, $1.2 trillion of assets. And stewardship is meeting up and talking to the companies that our clients and we have invested in, and ensuring that they are managing for long-term value. And our purpose is to help people save and retire better. And better isn't only measured in dollars or pounds. It's also the world in which you live and you spend that saving and retirement income. So we've long held the philosophy that the only way to generate value long term is to do so by delivering value to society, which means the critical stakeholders of a business, and that they're two sides of the same coin, effectively. So Section 172 points companies in that direction. Arguably, it would not be necessary if companies thought holistically and took a long-term approach. But the question is, does Section 172 help to nudge those companies or guide those companies in the direction of looking long-term and looking around at the dependencies on all their stakeholders? I think it does help, as the other panelists have said, but often we do have to remind companies of this. And we've seen it a bit in the pandemic. We've seen some companies managing their stakeholders well and being able to get through this process with their employee support. And I think it's worth saying that we did publish a case study on Tesco, on John's company, and saying that we thought it made big improvements in the way that it looked at risk management, looked after its employees. I noticed they paid a bonus to their staff last year, and they had a very good process of managing that change. Other retailers, for example, Walmart, Amazon, had many more questions to ask about how they've managed with that critical resource. We've done a lot of work with BP, for example, on its business purpose and its strategy. And we had to use quite forceful action to achieve that trigger of change through a shareholder resolution. As Vindi was saying, you've got to sometimes see a sort of pivot point that will achieve a change. But to Section 172, does it work? Well, yes, but there could be much more. I think there's two areas to think about. One is having regard for stakeholders is quite soft wording, and it does imply that you could regard and then disregard. And I think there could be a tightening of the wording in terms of explaining that you have to have concern and understanding of all impacts, and that the goal would be to have positive impacts. We should not forget that the whole reason a company exists is in order to serve society. That's why it's given special legal privileges. And we might talk about those, legal personality and limited liability. But also, I think Section 172 could indicate the long-term point. And much of this trade-off, this false trade-off, is between a perception of short versus long-term. And perhaps the words long-term or some guideline towards that should be in the wording. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bruce. We'll weave into the conversation now, but I'll start perhaps with one of the questions that's already popped up from the floor from Andrew Hobbs, who's interested in how the panelists view how best to communicate how the board has made the necessary trade-offs in public reporting. And maybe I'll stick with you, Bruce, to start with on this, and then come to John. What is looking like best practice already from what you've seen in Section 172 communication? Does a company doing this well have to indicate what trade-offs were involved in deciding, for example, in Tesco's case, whether or not to hand back business rate relief?
Yeah, I mean, I was just having a quick look at the guidance from the FRC on how to do a good Section 172 report, and it indicates that what you should highlight is not only all the good work done to kind of look at stakeholders, take into account what is fairly kind of intuitive, commonsensical, but to also acknowledge the difficult trade-offs, to acknowledge when there was short-term pain for long-term gain. For example, raising salaries. You know, we advocate for a living wage to be paid, which hits the bottom line, but we believe it returns its value multiple times through increased productivity, loyalty of workers, for example. And so a decision like paying back business rates, material, debatable, but I think the right thing when you're trying to manage a societal stakeholder that wants to see companies paying their way and understanding that support that they received through the pandemic that has really kept all of our investments afloat.
Yes, well, John, let me come to you, not necessarily to labour the point about the business rates decision, but you know, obviously in a lot of cases in corporate reporting, it looks as though concern is always raised on the board level when you need to highlight something that involves a disagreement. I mean, most notably, obviously, if auditors disagree with something, you'd much rather find a clean report than one that has a little glitch. And similarly in comply or explain, where, you know, the tendency is, well, we've just got to show we've complied here. Let's not explain where we're diverging from guidance. Does it require a sort of force of effort on the part of a chair or indeed of senior directors to get this element of trade-off included in section 172? Is that one of the things that you'll be suggesting, that we need to show where we've had constructive debate?
You know, yes, but Andrew, I think the critical thing is that people do the right things. They should then be able to explain after the event why they have made those decisions. And I don't think that explaining that, you know, if you've had a sufficient debate internally, may have been a very short debate because it's obvious to everyone that it's the right thing to do. If you've thought through what you're doing, you've made decisions, it ought to be relatively straightforward to explain it. And I have to say two things about investors, actually. First of all, being challenged and forced to justify those things by investors is a wholly positive experience. I spend quite a lot of my time doing that now because lots of people want to talk about ESG. I know a lot more about ESG than I did a year or two ago of necessity. But I think actually having to explain that, first of all, that's a good rehearsal, I think, for some of the stuff you may want to formulate. But secondly, I think the change in attitude on the part of investors shouldn't be underestimated, I think, at the moment. Look, when I was a young CEO, many years ago than I remember, I remember having an audience with a top 10 fund manager who will remain nameless, who picked up the annual report of the company that I was the relatively newly appointed CEO of, had noticed that we'd made a £25,000 donation to some sort of rather worthwhile charity. And I will never forget his words. What he said to me was the following. He said, "Listen, sunshine," that was the respectful way in which investors in those days, some of them at least, addressed young CEOs. "Listen, sunshine, when we decide to give our money to charity, we'll let you know." And I think that was not every investor felt that way, but there was a pretty strong strand that said, you know, your job is to deliver shareholder value. And frankly, anything that distracts from that is very bad news. That is night and day from the sort of conversations that we are having today with investors. I think some investors have come to the party quite late. People like Hermes have been there for a long time. Others are now catching up and are being driven by the fact that if they want a share of the investments that want to find socially responsible homes, they're actually going to have to up their game very considerably. But I think that's hugely positive and hugely helpful. And yes, it's sometimes demanding. But the fact that companies are held to account and have to explain themselves on that probably before they get to the point of making public reporting is wholly positive.
I want to come to Tracy in due course to talk about this long-term, short-term question that's already been raised a few times with the debt investor hat on. But Vindi first, on this point about, you obviously want to limit the divergence. In fact, you want to have no divergence between what's reported and what's actually going on in this area of stakeholder engagement. Is it one of those discussions that at GSK or other boards where you might be active that is now happening? You know, we need to be able to say something for Section 172, but clearly it has to reflect not only what's going on now, but also the sort of line of travel on some of these stakeholder engagement questions. What kind of discussions are you having to limit that divergence?
I think the first thing I'd say is that, to be frank, you know, we can think about what is reported, but actually the most important discussion happens around the decision. When you take any decision, it's really That's the discussion that's actually worth listening to, because that's the discussion. If you were a fly on the wall, you would actually hear how the company is thinking about things in the round. I mean, let's take restructuring, which is such a common topic. We know that companies require, they need to restructure their supply chains for very good commercial reasons. Now, the question is, how do they take those decisions? How are those decisions arrived at? Are they looking just at, you know, the efficiency of the supply chain? Are they thinking about the people involved in that? Are they thinking about how to reskill them, how to resettle them? Are they thinking about their pension liabilities? You know, there's a discussion in the round. And I think for me, what's important is that when these decisions happen, they're explained right away at the time. Actually, that's the most important moment when you take decisions. That's when they need to be explained. Yes, of course, then at the time of the year end, when the annual report is being put together, you know, you need to explain it in the annual report. But I think as far as the general public is concerned, or regulators or stakeholders or investors, there are conversations happening through the year. And I believe that what's really important is to explain to everybody, and it's the same story. You can't tell one story to one person and another to the other person. It's got to be the same story, because that's the truth. And I think, you know, people see that in companies when they recognize the authentic consideration of these interests or the lack of it. So that's what I think. I think it's just important to make sure that every discussion you have is looked at in this round, an important decision. I think for me, that's the most important.
Got it. Tracy, let me come back to the long-term, short-term question. And we're going to talk later on a little bit more about what can be improved in Section 172. But since Bruce has already raised it and mentioned that perhaps it should explicitly be asking companies to talk about the long-term, would that be a legitimate improvement from your perspective, when you clearly are looking at the long-term interests of the companies in which you have interest?
Yeah, I kind of take a slightly different view, kind of what Vindi was saying. There's a bit about reporting it, what you're saying or what you're doing, but actually the whole point about Section 172, from what I can, from my perspective, is that it makes companies think about it. You know, it's mm-hmm. The reporting is one thing, but the whole point is driving behavior and getting people to think about it. It's kind of like the, you know, the 30% thing with gender on boards. It's getting companies to actually, who may not be thinking about these things, and they may be getting pressure from external investors, but they may not. I mean, one of the things that Vindi said, I think it's really important, is, you know, what we're talking about is public companies, where probably the investors are more active in this space than perhaps private equity is. And private equity does own a huge amount of UK corporates and global corporates now. Kind of a different thing. They are more focused on the short term by nature. And so it's what I was coming back to before about investors really need to drive a lot of this, and all investors, all asset owners need to drive it, not just public market investors. And so I just think it's not so much about the reporting. It is very much about making sure that, you know, companies should be doing the right thing. They should be thinking about all of this stuff, and they should be thinking about the long term. Because if you do look after all of your stakeholders, then you will be successful in the long term. The problem is, from a structural perspective, we have got ourselves in a bit of a vicious circle when it comes to short-termism. And it comes from the fact that companies are reporting on a quarterly basis, but they report on a quarterly basis because their investment managers, the investors, expect them to report on a quarterly basis. They report on a quarterly basis because the asset owners, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, they all have to report on a quarterly basis against benchmarks. And so you get into this vicious cycle of everybody reporting on a quarterly basis, which is just driving all of this short-term behavior. So there are structural reasons why investors behave the way they are, and Section 172 reporting isn't going to solve that.
Yes, let me just go back to Vindi and give you, Vindi, just a quick right of reply on the private equity point that Tracy raised. It's not necessarily the main focus, but since you're wearing a private equity hat some of the time these days, just on that sort of long-termism, short-termism point that Tracy raised.
I think that I would say this. Private equity in general is, of course, more focused on the immediate. And the reason for that is that it is transitional capital. There is a hold period of 5 years after which that capital has to move back to its investors. It's the same chain. That's the promise with which that capital has been given to us. However, I would point out that my experience, at least, is that there's a very big seismic change happening in private equity as well. And I give you two examples of that. We have just raised our 11th fund in the firm where I am a partner, CD&R. 14 of the top 15 investors spent as much time on our ESG approach to our portfolio companies, both in terms of how we diligence them and how we then operate them through the period of our ownership as they did on everything else. And therefore, you know, it's the same pressure because actually some of the investors are the same people. So the same trickle-down effect that's happening in the public markets is very visible in the private markets. To give you another data point, this year, thankfully, we didn't have a Davos, and therefore we didn't have to go there to experience the snow. But last year, one of the sessions that I attended was a lunch with all the private equity CEOs and the investors. And I have to tell you, it was the most animated discussion on exactly the same topic we're having today. So I would say the landscape is shifting very much in the right direction. And our firm's view for what it's worth is that, you know, when we take on a business for 5 years and we have to exit it, we believe that if you run it with the right ESG agenda, you will actually create an embedded value plus above what your growth and your operational margin improvement is. And that embedded value plus will give you a higher exit multiple. You will command a premium for the embedded value, and we call it the ESG embedded value. And I think that's, if you begin to think like that, you can see that in 5 years, 5 years is actually quite a long time, you can make a difference. So it's changing, Andrew.
Right. Yes, the trickle-down effect is a useful way of thinking about it. I think across the board, also to Tracy's point about the Section 172 requirements being a sort of nudge for some boards that might not have considered this to be thinking about it. Bruce, can I come back to you on that and also weave in a question from Kate Sandel on from the Q&A? So this is a multifaceted question, but her main starting point is whether Section 172 enables the status quo to be maintained, and then goes on to talk about wider challenges of climate change, racial injustice, social inequality. Is it, I mean, it may be premature to start thinking of it as something that is going to bring about these far more societal changes, but is there a sense in which Section 172 might become just the kind of, we can do this as the status quo? Or is it nudging behavioural change, as Tracy suggests? Bruce?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it has nudged, but I'm not sure it's gone enough, gone far enough, because it was set back in 2006. So we've had, 15 years since then. We've had more guidelines, more requirements from the Corporate Governance Code, statutory reporting, to report in more detail, but on the same concept. But we don't, when we go and talk to companies, spend almost any time talking about Section 172. What we talk about is how to be long-term focused, more sustainable, more aware of material stakeholders. We actually put a lot of emphasis now on having a corporate purpose, a clearly articulated corporate purpose, which sits at the apex of a system of then strategy that that delivers for stakeholders and for investors over time. And if I go back to that example of the BP work, one of the things they did was to change their corporate purpose, that it was very clearly about reimagining energy for people and the planet. So putting the planet in there. And then from there comes the net zero goal. And then the CEO can talk with passion about how this now unifies his workforce in delivering something that they all believe in, rather than having a dissonance about cheaper oil that was harmful to society. And so that purpose, I think, is more important than section 172. And I think it's about the question of why a company exists in the first place. And it's there from the society grants it special powers and privileges to raise capital, to have legal personality in perpetuity, and to have limited liability in order to deliver back to society. And investors get their return on that journey. But I think the business purpose is more important than Section 172 per se.
Right. John, let me pick up another question from the floor, which is relates actually to the sort of way in which boards are equipped. Nigel Salter's asking whether boards are fully equipped to be effective in these evaluations. I mean, the overarching grandiose title of our session today is the stakeholder age finally arriving? And, you know, most boards, to be frank, as some of you have already mentioned, are set up for the shareholder age, which has not yet passed. So is there enough training in the latest thinking, as Nigel Salter says, on issues such as climate, ESG, diversity and inclusion? Is there a deficit on any of the boards you sit on that you think you can identify, and how's it being addressed?
Well, look, we work very hard. I wouldn't claim we're anywhere near perfection, but we work very hard to ensure that, you know, all of the issues you've just described, Andrew, get time at the board, that our board training program encompasses all of that. We have a lot of internal expertise within Tesco and increasingly within Barrett's, which is a rather smaller company, on those issues. And I think the, you know, the board are very committed to get up to speed. But I wanted to just echo also what Bruce said. You know, I think this issue of purpose is much more important. I see sections 172 as an enabler, an aid to it. But look, it's not what's driving the changing practices and attitudes of our major investors. This is a global phenomenon. It may be more advanced in some places than others. I don't think we should kid ourselves that just because little old UK passes section 172, that of itself suffices. I think it's part of a wave of actions that are going forward. But I think the other thing it's perhaps worth reflecting on for a moment, and why I think purpose is tremendously valuable, is that, you know, not every decision is taken at board level. Some very major decisions in large companies can be taken much further down the line. And if people actually understand what you're trying to do, if they are engaged in and buy into this notion of purpose, they're much more likely to get those decisions right in terms of the long term. And, you know, if I can quote an example, very early in the pandemic, the decision was taken to send, you know, 26,000 people from Tesco home on full pay because they were in clinically vulnerable activities. That decision was taken in a day, and it was taken by management, not by the board, because it was absolutely the right thing to do. When the board were told about it after the event, you know, everyone said, congratulated management on having been quick off the mark to do what they should do. And I think the huge power of purpose is that in managing to turn this from this notion somehow that, you know, you've got the board at the top who've got, you know, a monopoly of wisdom and they take all the big decisions and then everyone else executes them. That's just not the way businesses optimally should work. You know, for it to work, I think you've got to push decisions, but with the right mindset, down as far as you can in the organization. And that's what I believe increasingly good companies are doing.
Yes. I mean, Marla has asked a question that sort of touches on that, about the panel's view on practical application of Section 172 in a subsidiary situation. I mean, I wonder whether in what you've described, presumably subsidiaries of Tesco or indeed any company, they shouldn't really be worrying about Section 172. They should be worrying about the tone being set from the top. Or am I wrong? Is that something that you're trying to educate subsidiaries about as well? It's a board discussion.
Very briefly, I doubt if the vast majority of people who work for Tesco have heard of Section 172, but I'd be very disappointed if they weren't aware of our purpose and the sort of pyramid that Bruce described that supports it, and the way in which we measure as part of our Big Six measurement, our standing with our colleagues, with our customers and with our suppliers. So they see the practical manifestation of what we're trying to do, and I think they can understand the purpose. You know, I'm not sure they need to know about a particular legal requirement in a particular jurisdiction You know, that's something that we ensure the board we comply with, but it's not the main driver. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, I think it's supportive, it's helpful for the board, but actually if the board needs section 172 to get there, it's not actually as advanced as it should be.
Right. Let me come back to Vindi with another question. There's great questions coming in. Do keep them coming. Marcus Dowding, who's asking, you know, to what extent the board papers and other materials address section 172 to flag up different stakeholder perspectives, and actually links to an earlier point raised by Christopher Purney about embedding stakeholder perspective into the board discussions. Vindi, is that something that happens, or is the GSK approach, for example, still to say, well, we've got these various functions who are going to report, rather than thinking, okay, now let's look at it from a customer point of view, now let's look at it from a community point of view. How does that work in practice?
I think that the board papers that I see in the boards that I sit on, I mean, increasingly, certainly for GSK, which is the current board I'm on, the public board, actually do reflect all these considerations. And the reason is that actually when you're thinking about your strategy or your decisions, you have to start with your customers. You have to think about your suppliers. You know, you have to think about regulators. You have to think about how these concerns will, or whatever initiatives you take will land with your employees. You have to think about your, are they skilled adequately? Are they creative enough? So actually, the answer is yes, they do. They appear all over the time because, as I said right in the beginning, I think the company is run with a strategy that fully embeds a consideration of all the stakeholders that are necessary. That's the strategy. If you read the GSK annual report, actually you'll find that the section 172, I read it myself before this session, the section 172 bit is quite bland, but it's quite telling. And it is because under each of the stakeholder, what it says is refer to this page, this page, this page, and it, in each consideration, it takes you to 7 pages in the annual report, different pages. So what that's actually showing is that the section 172 report in the annual report that we have is just a signposter of where all the stakeholder judgments are being made throughout the company, throughout the annual report. So they come in so many different places. That just shows it's embedded as a way of doing business.
Right. Bruce, is that what section 172 should be doing? The pointing to other bits of the report? Is bland good in that sense?
Well, I think Vindi might be right there, that it's in order to change a behaviour and a whole culture of an organisation, which you should see then manifested in all that it's doing. So you would expect this to be sort of threaded through the reporting, not just sort of all aggregated into one single little lump here, and then we can go on to talk about the financial achievements of the company, for example. And a similar approach is being taken on specific issues, like say climate change, TCFD, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. It's to get all of that into the annual report and properly kind of embedded in strategy. I think maybe we should just pick up on something that Tracy said, because I think it's a very important point, that this section 172 is there to try to do that sort of nudge or reminder of something that shouldn't need to be done if you've got the right attitude anyway. And so you shouldn't really need section 172, and as it turns out, we're mostly not talking about it. But there's some incentive in the system, there's motive to deviate from that course. And I think it does come from that short-termism that is coming somehow down the chain and causing that quarterly reporting and short-term perspective. And I think that's something for the asset, for the investment industry to address. And I'm glad that Tracy highlighted that, because there's something wrong in the whole framework there that causes us to need things like Section 170.
Tracy, can I come back to you on that and just ask you to expand perhaps a little? I mean, you know, clearly from this, but do you feel like you're the sort of poor relations to equity holders on this question?
Oh, in debt terms? No, actually, probably not. I think it's probably the opposite way around. But I do think in all the work we've done on the purpose finance, you know, Mindy was talking about the purpose of the corporation, and John was as well. It's absolutely essential. When we started working on the purpose of finance series that we've done, we could find nothing in any academic literature that actually defined what the purpose of the finance industry was. And if you go out and ask people what the purpose of asset managers, investment banks, et cetera, is, most people say it's for them to make more money. You know, the finance industry is the linchpin of all of this. And it's kind of the elephant in the room in terms of getting them to define what they're there for, what their purpose is, and getting them to do the right thing, because they're the channel where all of this money is coming from. And the structure behind all of this is crucial to how companies behave, because they're responding to incentives. I was going to say just responding to incentives. But that's not true. They are responding to what they're being asked to do. And if their investors, who are representing millions of pension savers, et cetera, are asking them to perform on a quarterly basis versus a benchmark, well, that's what they're going to focus on. So we need to, I think it's really urgent that we look at the structural drivers in the industry and the financial services industry in general to understand why companies are responding the way they do. Because if you're not going to make an investment this year, that might, or you are going to make an investment this year that will pay off in 10 years' time, a lot of public equity market investors just aren't going to give you that leeway. So there are structural reasons that a lot of this is happening, and I think that's kind of urgent for us to discuss.
I think perhaps it's unusual, and apologies for the plug, but we do try to very clearly articulate our purpose is to help people save and retire better, because it's not otherwise clear.
It's very unusual. Yeah. If you ask any other bank, insurance company, you know, as a manager, very few of them do.
One of the things that I've noticed changing somewhat, and perhaps John, we can bring you back in on this as a chair, is that, you know, a couple of years ago, in talking to chairs about purpose, particularly with my hat on as chair of Blueprint for Better Business, which looks at bringing purpose to businesses, where I was chair until last year, there was often a point in the discussion where other chairs would say, well, we would do this, but our investors won't allow us because they're doing the short term. And John, I think you hinted earlier on that this is changing. You're beginning to have this discussion in a little bit more detail, not just with the Hermeses of this world, but with others about the E and the S and the G.
Absolutely. I wasn't hinting. I think I was stating it very, very clearly. I think there's been a revolution in the attitudes, well, a revolution in the practices of major investors. I think it's partly driven by self-interest, is wanting a share of this wall of money that's headed towards socially responsible investments. So I'm not suggesting it's entirely altruistic, but it is. It's definitely different, and I think it's helpful for companies that are trying to do the right things. By the way, I think I can give Tracy an example of a financial services institution that does have a purpose. I'd refer you to Nationwide Building Society. They have a very clearly articulated purpose, you know, building society nationwide. And I've heard their CEO at length explaining, you know, why that, what that's about and so on. So there are at least a few, but I would accept perhaps not all.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I've said I'm going to try and finish on the dot of midday, of 1 o'clock. So let me come back to each of you and ask, just very briefly, how you think this use of Section 172 and indeed all the wider things that we've raised might be improved. I'm coming to the conclusion we may have placed too much weight on Section 172 as the tool for doing something that should be running through the whole of companies, as all of you have mentioned. Let me start with Tracy and then Bruce on this question of what might be improved.
And as you said, I think Section 172 is what it is, and all of these reporting tools are just nudges to get companies to do the right thing. I think I've said it, you know, in all of our work on the purpose of finance, it's been about you know, the structural drivers of some of this behavior and what we can do to change them. I think that, that we need to look at that.
Bruce, can I come to you?
Yeah, I'd echo that point strongly, very well made by Tracy. But I think I mentioned at the start that the wording could be looked at. So the regard is sort of a loose, light wording and implies disregard could be the consequence. So that there could be deeper concern for positive outcomes for stakeholders. And I think also there could be that indicator that it's about the long term. And I think maybe to the point about business purpose, that all companies should articulate their purpose, and that's where the new emphasis is going anyway, but it could be picked up in these sort of duties. And I think that would help to explain what the when you manage the in the best interest of the company for the benefit of members, what is the company's best interest? What's it trying to achieve? What's it there for? And so explaining that that purpose, I think, would be important.
Yes, and Chris Turner in the questions has raised that point. You know, it's an opportunity to, not necessarily through 172 statements to establish the purpose, but it's another nudge, isn't it, to think about, you know, what are we here for? Even if 172 itself is not necessarily the place to enunciate that. Vindi, can I ask you whether you think there are things that could be improved either in the very practical sense of what's in the 172 requirement or in the way in which companies are working with it?
I think I'd hone in on the point that Bruce just ended, which is purpose. I think purpose is the key here. It is the Sudoku key, because it is so important and actually can be a huge aligning principle around and a litmus principle on all decisions. So it's really the key here to ensure that you go back, I go back, everyone goes back and thinks through purpose continuously. Purpose, by the way, is not a static thing. It keeps moving and it's a living thing. It reflects the world of today. You know, it's no accident that Unilever was the first company in the UK to employ women in their factories. Lord Leverhulme did that because he felt women were far more productive than men. And because they had to work in the night shift, he then built a village around the factory called Port Sunlight. It's no accident today that 100 plus years onwards, Unilever is one of the companies, the first companies to make a commitment on minimum wage. That is purpose. And that is a purpose that the core of which has stayed the same, but it's obviously moved and evolved with the times. So I think that would be my thought.
John, final brief word from you. Is there anything that would improve the way in which companies are using this? Clearly, we've heard some best practices here, but not everyone has got with the program.
No, look, I think we, you know, we've covered the ground. I think we've had some great contributions from my fellow panelists. I think that, you know, investors and government and other stakeholders keeping up the pressure on companies to explain themselves, to give an account of what they're doing is a wholly good thing. I mean, it can be irritating sometimes for companies, particularly when you're being pushed to do something you're doing anyway. I think some of my colleagues are thoroughly fed up with share action. But if you actually look at what they are trying to achieve and what we're trying to achieve, it's very consonant. And if they push us a little faster than we would otherwise be comfortable with, you know, there's very little downside in that. So, you know, I think we shouldn't get over focused on 172. I'd agree with everyone who said the real thing is, you know, has the company got a clearly articulated purpose? And then it should be capable of being held to account in terms of its how it's addressing that purpose.
Thanks, John. That's a good note on which to finish. We've passed the 1 o'clock point. So I think what we've really enunciated is that it's the substance rather than the reporting that's important. The reporting gives that nudge and then gives a way of holding to account. But it's the substantial moves that lie beneath that are really the most important part of what Section 172 illustrates. So let me just thank the panel, John, Bruce, Tracy, Vindi, thank you very much for your candour and interest in engaging with some excellent questions from the floor. So thank you also to those in the audience, and hopefully we'll be able to reconvene at some point to discuss some of the other implications of this as the use of 172 evolves. Thanks very much, and have a good afternoon.